if you like betting on golf. But everyone that you back misses the cut. Get some experts involved with all the stats and the tips and so much more. 'Cause it's the golf betting system. The golf betting system is the golf betting system podcast.
Greetings and welcome to the Golf Betting System podcast. It's episode 357. This is our 2025 US Open in-depth research podcast. Barry O'Hanrahan and Paul Williams join me, Steve Bamford, to discuss the United States Open Championship from Oakmont, Pennsylvania. How are you, gents?
Morning, chaps. Very good here, thanks.
Morning, guys.
This podcast is for listeners of 18 and above. Please be gamble aware. You can visit gambleaware.org for more information. And of course, please bet responsibly. Monday the 9th of June, we'll see my tips and Paul's long shots previews released along with our stats package and predictor model. We're available on X. You can follow us. Barry is at A Good Talk Golf. Paul is at Golf Betting. I am at Bamford Golf. We're on Blue Sky. Search for Steve Bamford and Paul Williams. Subscribe to the Steve Bamford Golf YouTube channel where this podcast is available every week. We are inching towards those 5,000 subs. So if you are watching or listening to this on YouTube, press that subscribe button for me. Now, you guys as listeners power this podcast, so we need your 5-star reviews on Apple Podcasts. As ever, for those of you who leave a review, I will read them out at the start of a future show. Leave your name and where you are in the review. This one's quite short and sweet. I know we've got a packed show. 5 stars is the title. Fantastic review, as usual, chaps. In-depth, insightful, and the hard work you do behind the scenes doesn't go unnoticed, exclamation mark. That is from G Shannon 9, and G Shannon is in the United Kingdom. Thank you for your time, G Shannon.
Brilliant stuff. Thanks for the review.
Thank you, G Shannon. I knew a G Shannon from my bowling days, but not from the UK. Good memory.
Maybe he's moved. Maybe he's come to join the party in the UK, and who can blame him? Right, let's not go down that rabbit hole. I want to start by highlighting the huge amount of free data available for the US Open at Golf Betting System. Paul is all ready to pull together major championship form stats. I'm going to go through them in a bit. We have a US Open form sheet plus combi sheet where current form is married with US Open form. Monday the 9th of June, we'll also see new and old format predictor models released. Can you believe all of this valuable statistical analysis is available completely free of charge? There is no paywall or registration required. Well, I've got to say, chaps, I just said this to my wife. I'm rather excited about this research podcast. And no barking dogs, because I'm in the usual studio. So that's I know a lot of listeners will like that. I'm going to start with this one fact, and I then want to go on to the course, because Oakmont Country Club, completely different to Quail Hollow, which we saw for the PGA last time, the last major. We haven't seen this course since 2016. There has been a lot of work done on it, and the course is really the star, being branded, of course, the most difficult golf course on the planet. But let's start with this little nugget. Recent US Open history features a new breed of champion, with first-time major winners galore. Indeed, going back to 2009, 12 of the last 16 US Open champions had never captured a major title beforehand.
I have an Oakmont stat to follow that up as well. Seven of the 9 Oakmont champions were first-time major winners.
Wow.
There you go.
That's interesting, isn't it?
Is that going to put a real spanner in the works on making any picks for next week?
Not necessarily. I mean, I think I know two of us have already backed one guy that hasn't got a major in his resume yet.
That's
quite
true.
Exciting, really.
And one who has a major.
why that is. It's hard to tell with a lot of these things. Let's take you through the course. I'm not going to even do it quickly. I'm going to take it for you in quite a lot of detail here. Oakmont Country Club, Oakmont, Pennsylvania. Henry Founds designed this course in 1903. Can you believe this was the one and only golf course this guy ever designed?
Brilliant. Pretty good one.
His brief was to basically come up with the toughest golf course imaginable. Brilliant. Apparently, they made the greens so fast here as well, I heard this morning, that this was the course that they brought out the stimp meter for, just to kind of... These greens were so incredibly fast, they needed to kind of record how fast they actually were.
Get that.
It had a Tom Fazio redesign in 06, but the one that we really need to concentrate is the recent one, 2023, Gil Hance and Jim Wagner. Now, Gil Hance has done plenty of renovation work recently. If you go to my US Open research preview, there's a full list of his courses doing some fantastic work right now. So as part of that, Paul and I were discussing this quickly off mic. They've invested in sub-air here just to make sure the greens are nice and crispy. So I don't know if you remember 2016, the players all arrived for practice and literally it was like putting on glass and it started to rain. It rained in competition and 4-under still won it, Dustin Johnson on Sunday. So it wasn't as crispy as they wanted. And I think it was it four players managed under par in 16?
Yeah, they did. And a lot of players dropping away, particularly on Sunday. And who's it? Jim Furyk came through, didn't he, to finish Jimbo. Second in the end?
He did. I've been watching the rerun of the final round, and Jim had literally done that first thing in the morning because I think Dustin Johnson was on something like hole number three, and you could see that Jim Furyk had already completed his round.
Yeah. Posted a score, asked the question at least.
Course type: classical, naturally. Technical, undoubtedly. Long, par 70. 7,372 yards. Holes with water in play, zero. Number of sand bunkers, 168. That's down from 2016 when it was 220-odd. So that's part of the renovation, less bunkers. Acres of fairway, 27 fairways. They are bent grass with poana, rough, Kentucky bluegrass with perennial ryegrass and a bit of poana thrown in. They are going to be 5 inches in depth. No graduated rough this year either. So you're either in the fairway or you're in this sort of 5-inch rough. Greens, a hell of a lot of work done on the greens since 2016. They've made them bigger. Yes, they've made them bigger. 8,500 square feet on average. I don't recall many golf courses with bigger greens than this. 8,500 square feet on average, featuring, of course, poana. I'm quoting here a tournament stimp of 13, but I reckon they probably want it quicker than that. Course scoring average in 2016, it was 73.52 for a par 70. It played at 3.5 strokes harder than par for the field. Of course, it ranked as the number one most difficult golf course out of 50 on the PGA Tour in 2016. Fairway widths, 18 to 28 yards wide, 300. Now, Barry, I thought of this. We were talking in the last pod about a Muirfield Village as a comp and as a good warm-up. For reference, Muirfield Village at 300 yards have fairways that are 24 to 25 yards wide at 300. So some Oakmont strips are really... really thin, and then others a little bit wider, up to 28. But compare that to TPC Toronto this week, RBC Canadian Open, 35 to 37 yards. So a lot of the field in Canada are going to see fairways pretty much 50 to 55% thinner next week.
Yeah, and what do you think about that then, combined with the non-graduated rough? What do you guys think in general about the non-graduated rough? And it just goes, it's quite binary then. It's just, it's your fairway or you are not. So there's no... Yeah. And it might actually be the case where you end up with, if players hit it a good bit offline, maybe 15, yeah. 20 yards offline, then they're in the, let's say, the spectator mode areas because yep. they've walked down the grass and they get a good lie.
Yep. 100%. 100%.
Yep. You've got this scenario where you've got sloping fairways in some instances and potentially the ball running quite a lot on the fairways as well. Mm. So you could potentially hit what you think is a pretty good drive, find the ball, and as you say, it's just gone straight into this non-graduated rough and you've got an horrific lie as a result of it.
Or somebody blasts one and they get the spectator-friendly lie.
This is it. I refer everybody to YouTube. Go and watch DJ's final round in 2016, and it was hole 10, I believe. He's hit this crooked 3-wood about 50 yards to the left of the fairway on 10, gets a drop, and he lands in this... The drop is just so... He's literally on the spectator path. He's got this brilliant lie. He takes this pitching wedge shot over the camera tower onto the green, makes par. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
That's a prime example right there of what can happen around this course.
Yeah, there's the breaks that you sometimes need as the eventual winner. To be fair, he'd been dealt a pretty bad hand, hadn't he, with that with the point or the penalty that he was being assessed for at the time. So to get a little bit of luck to counteract that was fair enough, I
think. Right. Let's go through some more detail. So Oakmont Country Club will undoubtedly be a stern test in 25 in a lengthened guise. At 7,372 yards, it's up circa 150 yards from 2016. However, it's obvious that in today's modern game, the course's defence is not overall length. This isn't a PGA Championship track, you know, where you're dealing with 7-8 par 71. 7-3 par 70 is long, but in modern day terms, that isn't going to cause any issues whatsoever. Oakmont is defended by clever course design, which includes the fastest Poana putting surfaces on the circuit, severely canted green complexes, 170 bunkers of the deep variety, sloping fairways, as you mentioned, Paul, a lot of uneven lies here. Mm. A number of blind or semi-blind tee shots. We know a lot of golfers do not get on with that. And traditional US Open style Kentucky bluegrass with perennial rye and poana rough 5 inches in length. Another aspect of the course which deserves note is its tactical usage of length. Oakmont contains the longest par 3 in US Open history, with the 8th playing 289 yards to the tips. At its maximum, this hole is on the edge of the shorter players' driving distance ranges. It also includes two 600-yard-plus par 5s. It's going to be interesting to see if Rory or Bryson or even Minwoo can attempt to reach in two. 170-odd bunkers add bite, and it's interesting that one of the few changes from 2016, you're going to love this, Barry, is the fact that rough has been reduced around the bunkers to maximise the number of bunker captures. Interestingly enough, from DJ, there's another hole. I'm just looking at my notes here. I think it could be... the 14th, where he goes again crooked with the drive, but it gets caught up right on a lip of a bunker, but doesn't fall into that bunker because it's nestled in the rough. Yeah. So they're going to try and minimise that with the course setup this time around.
I like that.
Exactly.
I like the idea. Well, they pride themselves in their bunkers being deep, so let's make sure they're part of the action. Mm-hmm. So yeah.
A penalty. There should be a penalty, shouldn't they? And well, they're almost a shot penalty around here. So
because they're so
like
deep,
an open championship.
Yeah. In theory, right now it sounds like this is an excellent course setup decision. Let's see how it plays out in practice. It could be wild. It might not be, but right now, all for it.
Gil Hans has made the bunkering even more difficult. Oakmont is famous for its church pews bunker, with fairway bunkers now getting on for an automatic one-shot penalty. Oakmont is also known for ditches which crisscross the property. In 2016, the USGA carved out those ditches to where players could get in there and play. They're ditches, but there's no water in them. In 2025, that won't be the case, with 12 to 18-inch high native grasses making recovery shots a nightmare. Other changes to note that will ratchet up the difficulty include the rough. We always discuss the rough, the length of rough at each and every US Open. And in recent years, we have seen graduated rough in play to alleviate the concerns of the players. But that won't be the case at Oakmont in 2025. The wet Pennsylvania spring has made it particularly thick, with the USGA topping it off at 5 inches. It will be higher as the championship progresses. Key areas of change from the Gil Hans renovation include the addition of more than 24,000 square feet of green surface, hence those 8,500 square feet on average number that we quoted. Encouraged by a vocal club membership who are well known to want their course to play as difficult as possible, Hans's work has made the notoriously fast greens even harder. Expect far more pin locations, and as ground superintendent Mike McCormick says, and I quote, "The greens are the number one defence on the course. Oakmont, in today's world, it's not a crazy long golf course. There are several holes out here where the players will be hitting wedges into, and it puts even more emphasis on the greens being our defence." So that's my summary. And I'll tell you what else I was going to do. I was going to take you through, because I think this is useful. I was going to take you through the clubs that DJ hit when winning here in 2016, just to get a feel for what they're playing here. So
I just want to jump in, Steve, and just say,
I love the
gaslighting in a way by saying the greens are our number one defence, at the same time having 5-inch rough, some of the deepest bunkers around that are effectively a one-shot penalty in most spots. That's a to-be-debated point about how, you know, bunkers, particularly fairway ones, I think a little bit of a chance to escape can bring more problems in for guys versus just having to, like, chop out. But then, you know, having the bunkers kind of set up, or the surrounds of the bunkers set up to bring the balls into them, and then not mentioning that and saying the greens are the defense, when it sounds like everything this course is set up to do is to make a player scared shitless and just be like, very rarely have a chance to be on the attack, but kind of fall into birdies and hope for comfy pars. And when it does go wrong, please God, it doesn't end up being a double or a triple.
Yeah.
We ask for this a lot on this podcast. I think I do more than most. So I'm very much looking forward to probably the most extreme version of this type of test that we'll see. I don't think it's for every week, but I'm fascinated to see it.
There's been this discussion, isn't there, going around sort of just under the surface about the relationship between the USGA and the members of Oakmont. And there's this battle going on because the USGA over recent US Opens have clearly made it easier for the players. But Oakmont is so on brand that it has to be as tough as it humanly can. This battle between membership and USGA seems to have been, and we're recording this before we've actually seen the course in tournament week. It seems to have pushed the USGA into a far more defensive stance, as in they're going to make this as tough as they can. And then I think it goes to future courses, and it will roll back again.
Do you think the US Open setup will be
Go ahead, Paul. Sorry.
No, I was just going to say, I think the setup on paper will be really, really tough. I think where they've got flexibility is with the pin positions, and they can turn an extremely tough course into a slightly more scorable course just by tinkering with those pin positions. So if they feel that it's too difficult, or if there's a moving day, Saturday, the pin positions are a little bit more generous, shall we say, allowing for a few more birdies, then you might have they got a target score in mind? Is it level par? As you said, DJ won at 4 under, four players under par. Angel Cabrera before that in 2007, what was 5 over? So, split the difference there. You're talking around about level par, and they can probably manage the course and the way it's set up to get that, to achieve that. But yes, on paper, it looks like it's going to be.
I'd genuinely be shocked if they let it go to 5 over. I don't think we're going to see that ever again. I mean, short that, put that on a short.
I think if it was super dry through the entire period, then potentially
they can always go out with some hoses, can't they? Early on a Sunday or Saturday morning, I'd be amazed if it's 5. But right, let's go through DJ final round and just the shots he hit. Right, number one, driver wedge. Number two, that's a drivable par 4, driver. Number three, driver wedge. Seen a pattern here? Number four, that's the par 5 with the church pews. He hit driver into the church pews, but it wasn't into the cross sections. It was into the sort of gully on the right-hand side, just off the fairway. He then laid up, wedge into the par 5. Didn't actually make birdie. Number five, that's more tactical. That was iron off the tee, then wedge. Six was a 7 iron into a par 3. Seven, driver 8 iron. Eight. Took 3 wood off the tee because that's the par 3. He's hitting 3 wood into that 289-yard par 3. Number nine, driver 7 iron. So that opening stretch there, a lot of wedges. Right, back nine. He hit the crooked 3 wood on 10, pitching wedge. 11. And it's just interesting. Bryson DeChambeau's practice round from last week has just come out on YouTube. It's been out for 10 hours. It's already got 850,000 views in 10 hours. He starts on number 10, hits driver because it's windy and cold. But he says, walking onto the green, next week we'll have to hit 3 wood here. So it's fascinating just to get these snippets of information. Right, number 11. 2 iron off the deck, off the tee, 8 iron in. So that's clearly a strategic hole, 11. 12 was driver, 4 iron into the par 5. 13, mid iron, because it's a par 3. 14 was an iron and wedge into a par 4. So the back nine, you can see it's a lot more strategic. 15 was driver and 8 iron. 16 was 4 iron into a par 3. 17 was driver, because it's a drivable par 4. And 18 was driver and then a mid-iron in. So, a lot of wedge work on the front. And then a lot more variety of both tee clubs and irons into greens on the back nine. So, my stance on that was that, I mean, bearing in mind, Dustin Johnson he won that. If you actually look at the statistics, and there was no strokes gained, unfortunately, but it would have backed up this. If you actually look at DJ, he was 317 off the tee, number one in the field. But it was his accuracy. He hit 64.3% of fairways. He was 18th in the field for driving accuracy.
That's a hell of a week with the driver at that distance.
That's just killing the opposition, isn't it? 76.4% greens in reg. Guess what? Number one. When he missed the greens, he was number one for scrambling. And he was 43rd for putts per green in regulation. That's the recipe, though, chaps, in my mind. Long off the tee, straightish, and just fantastic consistencies with your approach play throughout the bag, not just the wedges, but also the distance irons as well.
And mediocre at putting. Does that sound like the world number one to anybody?
Yeah. And this is the point, isn't it? It's you start to boil the numbers down and you're thinking, well, this just screams Scotty Scheffler. But yeah, I get all that, and I agree in large chunks in terms of what you said there. I think equally someone who's a little bit shorter off the tee and a little bit more accurate could equally
100%
equally achieve the same output and outcome.
Yeah, 100%.
I'd be shocked if we're not seeing two, three, four guys in the top 10 who are what we would classify as shorter hitters, but the more accurate types.
Agreed. Mm. This could be a US Open. This could be a very rare US Open where a short hitter wins. That's my view. Yeah.
Now,
do not put all your eggs in bomber basket.
Have you been looking at the weather report, Mr. Bamford? Because
I have.
Right now, it's not looking great for firm and fast as far as what I can see on windy. Seeing 3 millimeters tonight, another 5 or 6 tomorrow. Sunday, they're going to get 20 millimeters. Monday, they're going to get 12. And then it starts drying out. But on Saturday, well, the Saturday the 14th, we can forget that. That's so far away. But in the immediate future, in the immediate future, there's quite an amount of rain going to fall.
There is an undoubted risk of rain. You're correct. Now, I'm looking on a different app. I'm looking on vandergrund.com. And all of the rain chances, well, it definitely looks like Thursday and Friday there could be some significant rain. And then from Saturday through, it's all sub 50%. But clearly, different weather apps, whether that happens in reality. I reckon there will be some rain. Yeah, I think there's going to be some rain pre-build-up. I mean, spoiler alert, we're recording this on Thursday the 5th of June. But, yeah, I think there's going to be some rain in the build-up. Now, one thing Paul and I did know is there is sub-air on the greens now, which there wasn't in 2016. They can ratchet that up as much as they want. Mm. It has been a very, very wet May. 182 mil. Which is 7.2 inches for those of you over in North America. But June so far hasn't seen any rain, but like you said, it looks like Thursday and Friday there will be some precipitation on the course, or it's more likely that there will be than there won't be.
Just to clarify, that was the ECM WF model. When I switched to the GFS, there was a lot less heaviness in terms of millimetres, so hopefully that's the case. Because I'd love to, we all want to see it have that firm and fastness to it, so they don't have to hyper-manipulate the pin positions, you know, so they have that ability to set the course as they like, and to be able to adapt with, let's say, the scoring day by day, so...
You'd hate a Valhalla from last year where it literally rained overnight for the whole tournament.
Yeah.
And then you get people on X going, well, this isn't a major championship. It's not firm or fast. It's like, well, how would you make the course firm and fast when it's raining constantly?
Because it was in Valhalla. But
they can't really put an astrodome over the course overnight.
Why not? Right. Just weather gods, give us this one. It would be it would be incredible if we can get it.
I think, just looking at the forecast, it looks like there will be some rain, but I think to Steve's point, they can take the moisture out of it. Mm. Going back to 2016, the Wednesday was really wet. Mm. The Thursday, when they started play, well, they didn't complete the day, did they? Because it was so wet. And, you know, the course, when you look at some of the pictures and some of the old video, some of the greens were underwater, and they managed to get that back to a position where by Sunday, the greens were releasing, the greens were tough, and you're thinking, well, if that's how that's reacted after just a few days, if we're going into this with no rain so far in June and maybe the odd, you know, a thunderstorm or two in the meantime before they start play, I think, you know, you're going to be getting they're talking about potentially 30, 40 yards roll on the fairways if you hit the right spots. The greens are potentially, you know, firm. So you struggle really when you're approaching the greens is holding them. And, you know, that's where the challenge when you're combining that with the fact you can have these pretty damn slick Poana greens, what would you say, 13 on the stimp. But if you get a downhill putt from those, you know, you're on the wrong side of the green coming into it, then, you know, you're going to have a pretty treacherous putt. You're talking Augusta-esque in some instances, I suspect.
Speaking of kind of analogous courses and playing styles, like if the fairways do start running 30 or 40 yards, will we see a few links-like driving irons in players' bags to try and ensure fairways?
So, yeah.
And that then kind of might be jumping the gun here, but connects into previous, you know, Oakmont winners Cabrera and DJ, and what we had kind of talked about last week, having previous, not success, but good results at Open Championships.
I don't think it's a bad. We're going to have to see what the conditions are like, and we'll get a view of that when there's players on the ground playing their practice rounds from Monday onwards and talking about what the conditions are really like. Because again, they were talking pre-2016 about, you know, potentially 6, 7, 8 over par winning the tournament, and then the rain arrived and it completely changed the dynamic. But to still only get to a point where there's 4 players under par by the end of it, even with that rain, then I think it can play very different.
That point that Barry raises, I think, is vital to look into. So Cabrera, prior to winning here in 07, clearly we've got a guy here that's got a green jacket. So is Dustin Johnson, so throw that in there. Cabrera, Open Championship. He in 1999, he'd finished 4th at Carnoustie. And in 06, he finished 7th at Royal Liverpool. So bear that in mind. DJ, 2011, he'd finished 2nd at Sandwich. Remember that one? We went to that one, didn't we, Paul? Sandwich.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we did. Yeah.
2011. 2012, 9th at Lytham. 2016, 9th at Troon. That was clearly after he won here the US Open. So he had a second place at Sandwich in the bag and a 9th at Lytham before he won this in 2016. So there's Cabrera had 2 top 10s in an Open, and so did DJ. DJ then went on to finish 9th at Troon, 8th again at Sandwich, and 6th at St Andrews. And I'm just going to throw Jim Furyk into the mix, because there's a guy that's finished 2nd here twice. Short hitter. What's his Open Championship record like? Right, 97, 4th at Troon. So there's another mention of Troon. 98, 4th at Birkdale. 99, 10th at Carnoustie. So that links in with Cabrera. 06, he finished 4th at Liverpool. Well, that links into the 7th at Liverpool for Cabrera. And then he went on to finish 5th at Birkdale. And then in 2014, again, 4th at Liverpool. So it does kind of scream. You want players that have done well at least a couple or at least one Open Championship.
See,
that to me doesn't scream Bryson DeChambeau, because he hasn't got his head round Open Championships yet.
Well, no. And there's a question as to whether you're going to be able to take the Bryson line this week from off the tee and get away with some of the, you know, I don't think it's going to be a winged foot where you can just absolutely smash it and then just kind of chisel the ball out onto the green and win that way. The rough looks tougher, or tough enough to negate that. The bunkers look tough enough to negate that. So we'll see how he approaches it. It's certainly the case that you can take less than driver on, you know, to Barry's point on a number of the holes here, particularly if it is.
Well, he's already said in that video he's taking 3 wood off 10. So I think he's got his head around that you have to be strategic on a number of holes. I mean, I've counted there. 1, 2, 3, 4, DJ, four wedges in the first five holes and then just one wedge on the back nine. We know with Bryson, his wedge play, even though he's been working on his wedges at the White House, it's his wedge play, Paul, as you've very eloquently said over previous podcasts, especially the one after the PGA, that's the weakness with Bryson.
The distance control with irons as a bigger theme seemed to be a thing if we look back to the Masters.
Yep. Mm-hmm. No, absolutely.
And that's going to be very... Anybody who doesn't have their distance control with their irons going into these greens, it's going to be a very problematic situation.
Agreed. Mm. Two more angles here. These were the statistics of Cabrera and DJ in 07 and 16 in their previous outing before taking this out. Right, of course, and again, no apologies, no strokes gained data available for Cabrera. So I've kept this as traditional old man stats, Paul. You know, because we are sort of, we don't mind an old man stat still, do we? Cabrera played Wentworth, believe it or not, before the US Open. That's how it all used to be, wasn't it? Wentworth in May.
Yeah.
He finished in the top 10. He was first for driving distance, 27th for accuracy, first for greens in regulation, 7th for total driving, and 2nd for ball striking. 2016, Dustin Johnson, he played the South Wind Classic, or where I think it was back then. He was 2nd for driving distance that week, 3rd for accuracy. So it wasn't as if he hadn't flashed that, my God, he was hitting it incredibly long and incredibly straight. He was 10th for greens in reg, 1st for total driving, unsurprisingly, and 1st for ball striking. So DJ was 1st for ball striking and Cabrera was 2nd for ball striking on the outing before they won here at Oakmont.
That
makes
was animal
sense
by,
on a course like Oakmont, doesn't it?
Yeah, that was animal by DJ. Like 317.9 distance and 3rd in accuracy. Hit 66% of fairways. And this one by Cabrera was, I thought this was nuts when I saw it. You said he was 1st in GEIR, in greens and reg for Wentworth. He hit 83.3% of greens that week.
Wow, at Wentworth. Christ, that's an amazing approach play, isn't it? Because we know how small those greens are.
That is an alarm bell to back him if ever you saw one.
Yeah. Be interesting to see what price he would have been at the time. I guess with DJ, and well, certainly we'd all been bitten the year before at Chambers Bay. So, regardless of looking at those numbers from the week before, you're kind of still approaching it with a little bit of trepidation, or a lot of trepidation. But yeah, the numbers don't lie. He was undoubtedly hitting the ball very, very nicely and continued that the next week.
Safe to say I'm going to be crawling all over the numbers that come out of both the RBC Canadian Open and the LIV event that's happening in Virginia this weekend.
And anybody who played Memorial and is not playing these, right?
100%.
Yeah, we have to look at Memorial a bit as well.
I'm going to get those stats up on the screen right now, Barry. So fill in for me.
I think your point on total driving, and yes, I know it is an antiquated stat now, given that we've got strokes gained, but 4 of the last 11 US Open winners had led the field for total driving in their last outing. And a lot of it makes sense. You know, if you had a player this week who hit the ball a long way and hit a large number of fairways in such that they ended up leading the field for total driving.
Like top 30 in each?
Yeah, well, yeah, or potentially slightly better. I mean, if you get a player top 10 for driving distance and hitting 60% of fairways, for instance, then they're going to be towards the very top of that metric, and you'd expect them with any kind of middling performance on and around the greens to be in and around the mix, particularly if they hit a lot of greens in regulation.
What do you think, though? If somebody's hit, let's say somebody hits a 295 this week or 302 total average distance, but hits 60 plus percent, Like that's a green light for me in terms of that metric for that player going into next week. Just they're not getting a line through them.
No, I don't think they are. I think there's going to be more about strategy and control, I think, here. You know, dare I say it, potentially it's going to be about playing boring golf. Again, if you look at how DJ won that event back in 2016, he missed a lot of putts. You know, even on the final round, he missed a lot of putts, but he was hitting, you know, a decent chunk of fairways. He was hitting a lot of greens, giving himself chances. A lot of them weren't really close chances, but there was, you know, enough chances that he wasn't leaving himself difficult up and downs or difficult putts, and you know, which were encouraging three putts. And he kind of got to the end. Everyone else dropped away in the end. And Lowry was in pole position to win that tournament and couldn't stick around on the Sunday. So, yeah, again, it's as sad as it sounds, perhaps it does just all point to Scottie Scheffler.
How do we stop Scottie Scheffler winning this?
Yeah. Was it just a case of playing the without Scotty market and being done with it?
I'm ready to go, chaps.
Go on, Steve.
Memorial tournament. And Barry, I know what's happening here. Before I even say this, this is a real bet noir of the podcast. Second for ball striking. I'm not going to mention the guy that finished top because he's playing. I'm not going to mention players that are playing in Canada this week, okay? So, second for ball striking. He was 11th for greens in reg. And sixth for driving distance at Memorial. Wait for it. Keegan Bradley.
Is he not on the post-it note at this stage, Steve?
Not yet.
No, well, he is your, like, I don't know, is he your player crush? I think you love Keegan.
Now, oh, mate. Now, here's another interesting name. Tied for fifth with ball striking. Bud Cooley being one of them, but this is the more interesting name. I personally don't see Bud Cooley winning the US Open, although he is playing the best golf of his career for a long, long time. Fifth. Now, this is an interesting name. He was 27th for driving distance, so not a bomber, and he isn't, but he's long enough. Seventh for accuracy, 14th for greens in regulation. Harris English. Now, Harris English is an interesting name to me because when I've just been scouting around looking for courses where Cabrera's done well in the past, although he has got a very low PGA Tour history, where DJ's gone well in the past and where someone like a Jim Furyk's gone well in the past. So we're comparing yin and yang in terms of player shapes with Cabrera, DJ, and then Jim Furyk, who's 280 off the tee and whatever. One course that really jumps out is TPC Boston. Now, TPC Boston, last time they played it, Dustin Johnson won that by a country mile. Second place was a guy by the name of Harris English. And English has also won at Kapalua. Now, Kapalua is interesting because Jim Furyk's won at Kapalua, plantation course. Dustin Johnson's won there. And Angel Cabrera has got a very rare, because he didn't used to get many top tens in the PGA Tour, 10th placed finish at Kapalua as well. And what's Kapalua unfamous for? Uneven fairways. So that English number is very interesting. Anyone else? Oh, yes. In 8th spot for ball striking, Sepp Strucker. He was first for driving accuracy. Don't you just love it? He hit 80% of fairways. He was 10th for greens in regulation, but because he was 39th for driving distance, that clearly hurts his total driving and ball striking numbers a little. But he was 9th for total driving, 8th for ball striking. And we know, because I mentioned it in the last podcast, incredibly, he was first for strokes gained off the tee. Because he was so iron straight.
Ladies and gentlemen, he is who we're putting up against Scottie Scheffler in the gladiatorial battle.
I haven't mentioned Scottie yet, have I?
No, but he is like the... I mean, not always quantifiable by stats, even though he sets records alight all over the place.
Well, you can't the really throw him out either.
The guy's going to be in the top three or top four.
Like, so he was.
It's impossible that he won't be.
10th for ball striking. He was 2nd for greens in regulation. He was 16th for driving distance. And he was 36th for fairways hit. He has got this left off the tee at the moment, Scheffler. But yes, so, I mean, so if Seth, he didn't pick Scheffler on the basis that he wasn't 2nd for ball striker, I don't know. But you can't. You. This is the point. I made the mistake last year of putting him up for the US Open, but what screwed with Scheffler's mind was that Pinehurst number 2 course where it was all sand off the fairways. He couldn't compute that, couldn't get his head around it at all. He's not going to face that issue this year.
I think it was Andy Johnson. It was on the shotgun start. It was Andy or Brendan was saying that what kind of seems to cause Scotty to stumble a bit is when he perceives a course to be unfair or inequitable. So yeah, that merges well with the Pinehurst thing, that if you go into that scrub, you could get a really good lie or you could get a terrible lie.
That's right.
So I wonder if any aspect of Oakmont will sit in his brain like that, that it's unfair.
I'm not sure it'd be classified as an unfair course. If you get a bad shot, then you're going to get penalised for it.
But it's perception versus, you know, the objectivity. So if he perceives it to be unfair, then that might just be the little Achilles heel that prevents him from winning and allows hopefully one of our bets to do the job.
Just to your point on the Memorial, Steve, Scotty Scheffler was 2nd for strokes going off the tee behind Sepp. So he, you know, depends how you cut and which are the metrics you look at. But I guess in this modern era, if you're trying to find some kind of proxy for total driving, then strokes going off the tee probably isn't the worst of numbers. And yeah,
I mean, it's incredible, isn't it? I mean, I'm bringing up TPC Boston. People will be listening to this podcast going, these boys are crazy. But I only just bring to the party what I see with my own eyes. He's played TPC Boston once, Scotty Scheffler, in that 2020 tournament where DJ won by a considerable margin, didn't he? It was crazy. I can't remember the distance. Scheffler shot 70 in round one, 59 in round two, 67, 71, and finished in 4th spot. And how many green jackets has he got? Talking about Cabrera with one and DJ with one? Yes. Another course I found where you can link is the Travellers at River Highlands. Cabrera 9th and 11th. DJ's won there. Jim Furyk's got a 4th and a 5th there. Who won that last year? That was Scotty Scheffler, wasn't it? The Travellers. Yeah, I don't know. It's a big call. Going back to your point, Barry, is there anything that you could perceive that Scotty would find unfair about Oakmont? Bearing in mind, everyone goes in there knowing it's the toughest test in golf, apparently.
So it was, the PGA Championship, it was the mud balls that seemed to be a talking point for him as well. And that seemed to kind of land as an unfair prospect in his head. And to be fair to him, that kind of is. He has got so few. We're talking about beating the final boss in a video game at this stage. And it's not like we hate him, but he's so relentlessly monotonous in his victories now. It's that inevitability that kind of takes a bit of excitement out of tournaments. Mm-hmm. We want a bit of excitement when we're watching, so.
Yeah. Yeah, particularly if he goes into the lead into the final day, just seems to be absolutely untouchable.
Nine times he's been 54-hole leader, I read. I think it was a Justin Rayer, and 9 wins. So if he goes into Sunday with the lead, you know, it's probably over.
From a strokes game
perspective, my voice cracks.
From a strokes gained perspective, Dustin Johnson in that St Jude Classic before he won, second for off the tee, 17th for approach, 9th for around the green. He was second from tee to green and 47th for putting. Scotty Scheffler's numbers are going to just look pretty much like, well, in fact, they won't, because Scheffler's approach play was just unbelievable at the Memorial. He was second for off the tee, as you said, Paul. He was second for approach behind, I don't know, who was better than him for approach last week? He was third for around the green, and lo and behold, he gained almost 4 strokes per round from tee to green, ranking number one for tee to green. He was 34th for strokes gained putting. Losing.
Good enough.
Losing 0.01 per round to the feed. Field.
Yeah.
It's just madness. It's madness what he's doing.
We're going to have to try and find a way to oppose him if we're going to oppose him.
So if we were going down the route of opposing him, because I'm sure a lot of listeners will prefer that route to actually just saying, well, we might as well not bother, we'll just put all of our money on him to win at 3-1. By the way, Taylor Pendrith was the guy that beat him for approach play. I did say in the previous videos, if Taylor Pendrith has got any balls, he could well win the Canadian Open this week. Get that one out there. Who do we think in the betting has got a serious chance of beating Scotty Scheffler at Oakmont?
Right now, tough. Before the Canadian Open, I think there's a question.
And before Live Virginia.
I think there's a little question mark over what Rory shows up this week. Is he talking to the media? Where is he at? Do we have an explanation for no media talk at the PGA? That came out yesterday.
He did have a press conference, and he hated the fact that him and Scotty's drivers had been ejected, but only his name was mentioned in the leak that went out to the press.
So that's why he didn't talk to the press. Okay.
Yes. I missed that. I was
driving to my favorite place in the world where I currently am in Cairn. I'm fascinated to see how John Rahm goes this week. He's been doing just fine. He has a very solid week on Liv, then kind of backs up money I already have on him since last week. I think he's got that brute power that can make a small strokes gain difference when you do miss those fairies, when he's out of that rough.
Can I give you a little bit of a reason to further like John Rahm?
Please do.
I had a little look at the predictor variables as they would be right now for next week. Some of the key stats, and of course we're playing Poana putting services next week.
John Rahm on Poana,
it isn't the most common of surfaces, so we see it quite a bit on the West Coast, don't we? I wonder how different the West Coast Poana and the
a lot Poana different here. Apparently,
it's aesthetically it looks. The Pennsylvania Poana looks far lusher, doesn't it? It looks far greener.
Yeah.
Looks far smoother. But let's roll with the raw stats. So I'll read through the top six, and there's some interesting names in this, actually, of Poana performances as it stands right now for the predictor variables for next week. Sixth, Tony Finau. Fifth, Colin Morikawa. Fourth, Justin Rose. Third, you like this one, Steve, given what you've just said, Harris English. Second, Patrick Cantlay. And first, John Rahm.
I want to reach for my mobile and go on my Betfair account. But I've tactically put it upstairs so that it can't impact on our recording.
Yeah.
Or make impulsive bets before getting full context on stats, which I've often done.
Well, can't you do it on your laptop? Oh, I can't remember the password. But yeah.
It's interesting. I mean, of course, you know, with all of the, and I've mapped a couple of the variables, and of course, we've got the Canadian Open happened this week. We've got DP World Tour event, and as you say, you've got Live Virginia as well, which won't filter into that, but worth keeping an eye on. So there's events happening this week that are going to change and skew some statistics, but it certainly won't skew the Poana statistic for this week. So yeah, John Rahm's got a good record, hasn't he? He's got a record to consider for next week in that respect.
Mental approach to this also, in terms of motivation, mental motivation to win, formed part of my reason for backing Rahm as well, in that he really seems to want to make a proper statement. Probably feeling a little bit invisible on LIV, not getting, let's say, the spotlight or maybe the recognition he feels like his game deserves.
Who do you think's winding him up? Do you think it might be Bryson's success?
There's loads of little elements to it, but because we can't get a grasp of how good the guys are on LIV, we do get the strokes gained metrics. Data Golf manages to kind of take those in, but it just doesn't give us that clean picture we could properly trust, that one that we know for years by seeing them play on the PGA Tour. And so his metrics come with a little bit of opaqueness to them, and it just seems like there's a wanting to prove a point kind of vibe about him at the moment. And that could be that small 0.5% difference that I'm hoping is there for the bet and materializes in him going on to win.
Potentially. I've got another little bit of analysis if you want to hear that.
Just wait for 30 seconds. I need to bring this up. Hmm. Where did Jim Furyk win his 2003 US Open? Do you remember?
No.
He won it at Olympia Field. He beat Stephen Leaney by 3 shots. Now, Olympia Field, you might recall, they played the BMW Championship there in 2020, in 2023. So it's a really old-style classical golf course in Chicago, Illinois. Yeah? You listen to these names. John Rahm won the 2020 BMW Championship, and he won that in a playoff from Dustin Johnson. I don't know if you've heard of him. Dustin Johnson, they both shot 276, and they had that mega playoff. Yeah? Rahm was victorious. Just for the record, Matsuyama third, Joaquin Neiman was third, Tony Finau fifth. Then, 2023, Barry's going to love this. Same course, BMW Championship. That was taken out by Victor Hovland, who shot 61 in the final round to win by 2 shots, from Matt Fitzpatrick, and guess who? Scotty Scheffler. Fourth was Rory. Fifth was Brian Harman and Max Homer.
T10 was Harris English. Just to loop in Harris there for your... But I'm
Harris
assuming
English.
Is going to
well,
be
Harris
a bet.
English was 10th in that, along with Corey Connors and Tom Kim. Do you remember when Tom Kim could play golf? So Harris English has a top 10 there as well. Where's my phone?
I got you, Steve.
How did I start the show? How did I start this? Let me go. Recent US Open history features a new breed of champions with first-time major winners galore. Indeed, going back to 2009, 12 of the last 16 champions had never captured a major. And what did you then follow up with, Barron?
7 of the 9 Oakmont winners didn't have a major.
Interesting stuff. I knew this was going to be a great research podcast. I could feel it. Anyway, Paul, trends. Yeah, continue.
Yeah, just a couple, and actually these quite brutal trends that I've gone through in both the Masters and the PGA Championship, they've both produced a winner. Now, it's not going to be particularly difficult when you've got Rory and Scotty as the winners, but at least it has highlighted them. So I thought worth doing again for this one. So if you want to chop the field down a bit, if you go back to Webb Simpson in 2012, then every US Open winner since then has had a top three finish or better in the season to date. Many of them much better than just a top three finish, but a top three is the cutoff point. And that includes DJ back in 2016, who'd finished third in Houston and third at the Memorial as well. And as you said, he finished fifth the week before at St. Jude, didn't he?
That's right.
Southwind,
yeah.
Bryson last year, just to bring it to life, second at Valhalla the previous month. So he had also finished top three at one point in the season. So every winner back to 2012. So you're missing out a few players like Patrick Cantlay, who's only got a best of fourth this season, Tommy Fleetwood, Jordan Spieth, Aaron Rye, Tony Finau, your mate Keegan Bradley, Steve, only got a best of fifth. He'll have to probably just settle for a first round lead next week and be done with it. DJ, best of fifth this season. So there's a few names that may be quite popular that don't fit that bill. Mm. Bob McIntyre, Xander. Xander's got a best of eighth this season. Of course, he's had his injury problems. So if you chop the field down to just those players who've got a top three or better this season, you're down to 61 players out of the 153 that I've got at the moment. I think there's another three to be confirmed. So you're chopping the field down by a good chunk. Then the other point is, again, it's a similar point to the one that I've made at the PGA Championship, and it's the performance at the previous major championship. And that's been a really good pointer of late, if you exclude the Wyndham Clark win.
Yeah.
Because Bryson had finished, as I just said, he'd finished second at the PGA Championship before his win last year. Sixth at the Masters as well. So he'd been playing some really good stuff in the majors. Matt Fitz was fifth at the PGA. John Rahm was eighth at the PGA. In 2020, Bryson was fourth at the PGA. Gary Woodland was eighth at the PGA Championship. So top eight finish in the previous major championship has been really indicative of performance in five of the last six US Open winners. And I think you can, with Wyndham Clark, there was this whole kind of psychological angle, wasn't there? It had some help from a sports psychologist, and that had really turned him round. And, you know, you could argue that kind of negates any previous major championship performance. So I'm happy to have that as an outlier. So if you overlay top eight performance at last month's PGA Championship, as well as this top three or better performance in the year to date, then you've only got nine players left. And they are Scottie Scheffler, as you would expect, Bryson, John Rahm, Barry, Joaquin Niemann. Interesting to see how Niemann goes, actually. That was his first. He's been underwhelming in majors, hasn't he, up until now? And that was his first real sign.
Top 10, yeah.
He's starting to get to a point where he's getting to grips with the majors. Ben Griffin playing some outstanding golf. Harris English, Steve.
Mm.
And then three other longer-priced players. It was an odd PGA Championship, I'll give you that, because there were some longer-priced players who managed to squeak through. But Ryan Gerrard and Joe Highsmith also fulfilled that criteria. So Davis Riley, Ryan Gerrard, and Joe Highsmith. But of the shorter-priced players, English, Griffin, Niemann, Rahm, Bryson, and Scotty are the ones that fit the bill. So interesting correlation there with some of the names that we have discussed in the past hour. Food for thought.
When are the extended places being announced so I can get a proper bet on Harris English?
Yeah, you may get some from tomorrow. You may see some from Friday. In fact, you may see some later today on Thursday, but yeah.
They did most rush at the PGA, but that was the same. What was happening? Was that the FA Cup final? And I think it was a big sporting weekend.
And you've also got three tournaments running this week as well. So the bookies may want to take a more detailed view of how things are progressing before.
Have you got a Unibet account, Barry? 125-1 Harris English, although it's five places and a quarter of the odds.
I don't have a Unibet account.
No, nor do I. He's 100-1 with William Hill, six places each way.
Is he longer on Unibet than he is on the exchange?
Couldn't tell you. But he does seem a cracking bet. And he came up very high in Dave Tindall's piece trends that came out yesterday about trends. I think he was top three, something like that.
You'd want to open a Unibet account, Steve, because he's 110 on the exchange.
What do you think I'm going to be doing in the next 5 minutes? No. That's crazy. I always point out Dave's pieces in our research podcast. They are a thing of beauty. Well worth a look. He has Scotty Scheffler at 73 points, topping his analysis. Second place, 71, Harris English. And tied for third, John Rahm with Xander. And fifth, Bryson DeChambeau.
Interesting. Interesting that those... And I haven't looked at Dave's piece this time before the pod. Interesting that those numbers are converging in a very similar fashion to some of the stuff that we've discussed.
Yeah, thanks for the spoiler, Steve. I was looking forward to that piece. Apologies on behalf of the podcast for Steve ruining the article.
Oh, dear.
I apologise profusely. Do you think we've covered all of our content, chaps?
I think there's plenty to chew on there.
Steve, I'll go heads up bet with you next week. I'll take Sepp Straka, you have Harris English. I know it's an unfair bet, but you like a bet, so let's go.
I'd prefer both. Lager. I'd rather have both on my account, to be honest.
Oh, you can back both, but let's have a head-to-head one as well for a pint.
Well, trends-wise, I'll take Harris English.
Perfect. I've got the tank.
But as we saw with Wyndham Clark 2 years ago, one last thing, actually, I was going to say this. Do you remember the Philly Cricket Club a few weeks ago?
Mm-hmm.
Remember how it looked? Kind of open, wasn't it? Old style AEW Tillinghast course.
Beautiful,
A course where driving distance became fairly redundant to a certain extent. It was all about accuracy. Who were the two guys fighting it out in the final group? I also had very similar greens to this. You know, the greens that are on... It had like a runway up to the green with the short grass and then onto the putting surfaces. That final group who fought it out for victory. Shane Lowry, well, he didn't do too badly in 2016, did he? You know, leading pretty much all the way until the turn on Sunday. And Sepp Straka, who won. The truest. And Sepp Straka has got a major top 10. In fact, he's got a major second place at the Open Championship.
And he's had a good Masters before.
So there is a lot of positivity for me on Sepp Straka. That's why I backed him at 60s on the exchange last week.
Harris English was T11 at the Truist in Philadelphia Cricket Club, yeah. Xander T11. Rory was T7. Tommy Fleetwood with his Sunday 65 to be T4.
Oh, please don't mention Tommy.
Go on.
Oh, please don't.
Justin Thomas was T2.
I do not see Oakmont as a Justin Thomas track. He is going to be in the hay, chaps.
Steve, you're banned from back in JT.
No, there's no. I can categorically tell you he is not in my thought process. 0.01%. It's just not happening. No way am I putting JT up for this. It's quite, I mean, looking at the odds market, you can't discount Scheffler, state the obvious. You can't discount DeChambeau. You can't discount John Rahm. And I'm still very interested in how Ludwig plays this week, because I think this course could potentially suit Ludwig. Long, straight driving. But you'd want to see something from Ludwig in terms of control of his approach play, consistent over 72 holes. And apart from that, I'm seeing no one sub 40 to 1 that I'm interested in. What do you think about, last question before we move on, what are your two thoughts on Wacky Neiman for this, bearing in mind his top 10 at the PGA?
I think that is an interesting step forward in his career, and all that given the springboard to move forward, I suspect so. Will it be this week? And will he win? I don't think so.
Barry?
Do you think it's low? No, I don't think so. The low ball flight might be an issue if the greens are, get to the point where they're firm, fast, and releasing.
Yeah. You don't want to be bouncing and then bouncing straight off the back of them.
Mm-hmm.
You got to stay under the hole here. You got to get yourself in position.
Extra bit of height and control in your approach shots.
Yep.
Good step in his career, very much so. Getting that top 10 in a major was like a thing he was probably getting asked about very regularly. Now he's like got that kind of monkey off the back. He can start refocusing on the next. But yeah, just for me, no, I'm not going to be betting on him next week.
Okay. Thanks for that, chaps. Right, let's call it a day, I think. Are you around for the Tips podcast next week, Barry?
I am. I'll be tired, but very happy after my holiday.
Right, that closes our US Open research preview pod. We will be back next Tuesday for the Golf Betting System US Open Tips podcast. Don't forget, I will put a link through to my preview in the description. And if you want to start perusing the data, Paul will be putting it up over the weekend in terms of the stats. You'll be definitely putting up the majors sheet, won't you, Paul? The majors form sheet?
Yeah, I'll put preliminary sheets up for all of it today on Thursday. So it'll be that by the time this podcast's out, people will be able to see it.
Excellent. Just for interest, Scotty is number one in our majors sheet for recent performances. Xander, Rory, John Rahm, Colin Morikawa make up the top five. Right. See you again next week, chaps. Goodbye.
If you like betting on golf, but everyone that you back misses the cut, get some experts involved with all the stats and the tips and so much more. 'Cause it's the Golf Betting System, the Golf Betting System.